outside, or if they're living in cities, it's because they're working. But what to do with all the non-devotees who live in cities? Doesn't seem like we have an idea anymore. It's very difficult, the urban scene these days. Generally, when you have a successful temple in a city, I'm generalizing, there are always exceptions, but when you have a successful temple, it's because there's a very big Indian congregation which is always ready to fork over the bucks, and so the temple immediately gears itself to that because the temple has to survive, the deities have to be served, and so you go on the path of the least resistance. You know, if there are many fortunate, pious Indians who, due to their fortune and piety, are wanting to give support, why not gear everything to them? Just like that is the situation now in London. They'll admit to that. That fabulous preaching to the Hindu community. If you are from Indian background, first, second, third generation, whatever, your chances of becoming Krishna conscious or getting very nice treatment in Krishna consciousness in London are extraordinary. But if you're British, tough luck. Therefore, very few British persons have been coming forward to Krishna consciousness as compared to the 80s when they couldn't find room for them all. The situation has become so the reverse that I've had British devotees telling me that, well, you know, British people aren't interested in Krishna consciousness. I mean, you know, they're not like the Americans. The Americans are cultured and pious, but but the British, you know, they're just not ready for Krishna consciousness. This is the same country which during the 80s was just, you know, piling in new devotees week after week. Now it's all forgotten, and they're having fabulous success with the Indian community, and of course that should go on. But meanwhile, the host population has been completely neglected. Mukunda Maharaj was pointing out to me if you're very successful with 2% of the population and neglect 98%, what is the use? How can you feel that you're actually doing your job? So you'll find it like this all over the world, that basically ISKCON doesn't really have a clue anymore of how to reach people in the cities now that the countercultural movement has long been dead, and whatever after effects from the countercultural movement that lingered on, that's faded now. What to do? So, therefore, you find in most cities of the world that our strategy is, well, you know, you open up a temple, you have deities, people come and sit on the floor, they look at the deities, and if they want to be Krishna conscious, okay, yeah, it happens. If not, I guess they're too fallen. That's basically the way it is now. We're doing a lot of things mechanically. They're transcendental, of course, but we don't have enough devotees who are thinking about this problem as their life and soul. Everyone is basically ignoring the problem. Hey, you know, what's the problem? We have a temple. We have a floor, a marble floor, where the people can come and sit on. And we don't bother them. We don't give them heavy preaching. We leave them alone completely. If they want to eat something, you know, if they happen to mention something that, you know, they'd like to eat something, or if we happen to think they might want to eat something, you know, we bring them a ghee-soaked puri, and sabjis, you know, half of sour cream, and, you know, not understanding that so many people these days are health conscious. So this is what's going on. And maybe they can give a donation. If they give a donation, okay, we'll put them on our donors list we keep by the door. It's like this all over the world. And also, maintaining urban properties is very expensive, and so therefore, for properties that are not paid for yet, devotees have to go out and collect, and they're always absorbed in money-making schemes, to the extent that actually outreaching to the people has been neglected. So this is the unfortunate reality. These are the bare facts. Now, let's discuss some other differences between now and 20 years ago, 30 years ago. You see, the world has changed quite a bit since so many of we senior leaders who joined Krishna consciousness in the late 60s and early 70s, so much has changed. And sometimes we leaders don't realize that. Here's something that I wrote for the British National Council. And this will give you some idea of the changes you may perceive. Cities today are more of a barrier to preaching than ever before. The sad truth is that in cities outside of India, the battle for maintaining even just the basic dignities of human civilization has been lost years ago. Most of our senior leaders in ISKCON began their devotional careers in the 60s and 70s. Without a doubt, that bygone era, those times, were much more socially stable and sane than now. Riley, if you wanted to be cynical, we could label the urban social psychological fabric of 30 years or so ago as the Satya Yuga when compared to the present Kali Yuga rat race. When your senior leaders of ISKCON were in their late teens and early 20s when they came to Krishna consciousness, they could not conceive that things would get more degraded. We just thought like hippiedom, that was like the outer limits of degradation. But no, those days were the Satya Yuga. Basically, let's say, in the 70s and 60s, when you were a kid, you didn't really do wild things until you were at least 18. So most of the leaders who came to Prabhupada's movement, they were good, you know, other than meat eating, you know. They didn't really do anything wild until they were 18. They went away to university. And then they really got into it. And at that point, Prabhupada scooped them up, many of them right out of the university, right out of the hippie communes. After they dropped out from university, they joined a hippie commune. So Prabhupada scooped them all up from there. But now, what is the reality? When I talk to young people all over the world, they all tell me, they laugh when they hear that we didn't do anything until we were 18. They just laugh. Because they're starting it at 12 and 13. That's normal. Intoxication, illicit sex, starts at 12 and 13. So when they hear that we didn't really go wild until we were 18, they just say, oh, what did you guys do with your life? How could you wait till you're 18? For example, I just saw statistics from the UK. Sociological statistics, not hearsay, which reveal that of all 11-year-olds in the UK, 25% are having sexual relations. This is the reality. So what's going to happen when they're 12 and 13 and 14? Basically, what's happening now is that by the time young people are 18, 19, and 20, they're generally physical and psychological wrecks. And this is something that the senior leaders in the Hare Krishna movement did not experience in their youth. Because, let's say, if you're a goody-goody, except for meat eating, until you're 18 or 19, then you go on a binge until you're, 21, 22, then Prabhupada picks you up. Basically, Prabhupada's got you after about 2 or 3 years of wildness. So, okay, you get thrown into the Brahmacharya Brahmacharini ashram. You know, you're completely a spacer for the first 4 or 5 months. After about 4 or 5 months in the ashram back then, you start to stabilize. After a year, you really start to get productive. Now, what is it like? ISKCON is getting people who have wrecked themselves since the age of 12. So by the time they're 20, 21, 22, they come to Krishna consciousness. Many of them, they have had at least, at the very minimum, 10 years of horrible self-abuse. They come from broken families, families of abuse. They've been abused. They've abused others. They've been inundated with illicit sex. It's just, you know, what's the big deal? It's like drinking water. All forms of intoxication. And then after at least 10 years of that, suddenly they come to Krishna consciousness, burned out. Now what are you going to do with them? If you take such people and throw them right into the ashram, you're going to have big problems. It's not like, you know, the days of yore when you were dealing with 2 or 3 years of horrible abuse, horrible habits, Kali Yuga vices. Now you're dealing with minimum a decade. Persons who started this when they were 12 and 13. And so their whole psychology, their whole physiology has become Kali Yuga saturated. And it's not the exception, it's the rule, it's the way they are. Their health is horrible. Lidhar Gupta, he can tell you about this. Health is horrible. Their brains are a wreck. And you're going to take these people and just, okay, you've said Hare Krishna, into the ashram you go. It just doesn't work. It doesn't go like that anymore. And what's happened is that devotees have noticed that in their preaching, and a lot of preachers have lost heart. They don't know how to cope with this. What's the use, they say, rightly so, in taking people like this and putting them straight into the ashram? All we do is get problems, you know, court cases, you know, abuse, you know, all this and that going on in the ashrams. Okay, what's the solution? Just forget this urban preaching. It's too hellish. That's basically the unconscious wind that's blowing. Oh, it's just really hellish out there. I mean, phew. Just take care of yourself. Just live a sattvic life for yourself. But, gosh, how can you cope with these people? That's basically what's happened. An attitude of defeat. Look, we tried putting these kind of people in the ashram. They end up causing us court cases. They do horrible things to other devotees. And what's the use? I know one temple president in the U.S., I won't tell you where, is a very senior devotee. He's been a temple president for like at least a quarter of a century. He's also one of our, he's been long-standing GBC members. So he just told me point blank, look, I've had it preaching to Americans. I've just had it. I mean, you know, forget it. They just bring you problems, you know. We don't need it anymore. We get sued, you know, this court case, that court case, child abuse, Robin George, this, that, the other. Tired of it. And then they criticize you. You give your life to help them and they turn around and criticize you. You forced me on Sankirtan, or you made me engage in devotional service, or, you know, 10 years ago when I was a new devotee, you looked at me with the wrong look, and on and on it goes. So his conclusion is, forget it. I'm not preaching to the host population anymore. I'm just going to deal with, you know, those, you know, fortunate, pious Indians. They're great. You know, you don't have to feed them, clothe them, marry them. You don't have to do anything, you know. They've got their own cultural activities. It's going on nicely. You just give them a little service, accept donations. Life is peaceful, yeah. As for dealing with the people who live in my own city, forget it. I mean, you know, I'm going to have to completely deal with their life. I'm going to have to teach them how to eat, teach them how to dress, you know, keep the boys and girls from clawing each other. You know, it's just too much. And then I'm going to have to arrange their marriages, or and then they'll criticize me if I arrange their marriages. You suggested I marry that one, and now it didn't work out. It's all your fault. What's the use? I don't want to hear this anymore. I'm tired of it. Better I deal with the Indian population because they're civilized. It's true. They're civilized. They know what civilization is. They know what a marriage is. They know what a family is. You know, they know what cleanliness is. I'll just deal with them. So he went into that kind of mood for 10 years, and he's now just now coming out of it. Yeah, maybe I should start preaching to the host population again, but what do I do? Yeah. So I'm just telling you all these things so you can understand the what's bubbling all around. It's really a mood of resignation and whew. But you don't say it like that. You know, Hare Krishnas, we never really say what we feel. Kijai Prabhu Sankirtan Kijai, preaching Prabhupada Kijai. But actually, in the heart, there's a deep mood of resignation, like, oh, my, who can deal with these people anymore? Many older devotees are like that. Many older Prabhupada disciples, they've actually just, what's the use? Because we were not prepared to see such degradation. We thought the hippie days was the outer limits. And you know, and you'll find in Prabhupada's purports from time to time, he makes comments about the hippies. They're immortalized in the Bhaktivedanta purports. And that was the outer limits. But oh, they're nothing compared to what's happening now. Nothing. When we were young, persons my age, those in our 50s now, when we were teenagers, your parents wouldn't let you do, you couldn't do whatever you wanted at home. You had to do what your mother and father said. Divorce wasn't that common. There were still some traditional family values. Now, forget it. What's happened is that children from wild homes have become parents. And so, obviously, they have no idea what to teach their children. Just like in an Indian family, cultural ways are handed down from generation to generation. This is how you act. This is how you behave. These are the goals and values you should have. That's all come to a halt in so many countries around the world in terms of the West. So what you see is the young generation of 10 or 20 years ago, which came through wild circumstances, they have children. Sooner or later, they have children. That means they have no idea what to teach their children. And so it just gets more wild and more wild with every generation. And so our temples don't know how to cope with this. Because our temples are based on sanity, at least mode of goodness. Come in, sit on the floor, cross-legged, be quiet. You know, you've already taken a bath, all sorts of high values compared to what's going on now. And we don't really know how to relate to what's happening these days. So what is happening? First of all, you have two categories of people. You have those who have, I've written here, many young Western candidates approaching Krishna consciousness today have routinely experienced from a tender age horrific assaults on their mental and physical well-being. Too frequently, overdoses of sex and intoxication combine with myriad forms of abuse to produce an internal wreck, a viable human in appearance only. That's the urban reality. Then again, here's the other category. If someone has managed to escape such devastation, that is, if they've survived into their 20s or 30s with part of their brain and dignity intact, often professionalism and career consciousness keep them away from our doors. Corporate downsizing, competing in the job market, and staff redundancy is their fear, not repeated birth and death. So this is basically what you're going to see if you try to reach out to people in the cities on a regular basis. You're going to see those coming from the horrific backgrounds of psychological and physical abuse, even if they have money, even if their families have money. You're going to find people don't know what gender they are. Everyone's experimenting this way and that way these days. I've seen statistics, for example. 40% of American university students have experimented with bisexual affairs. In other words, if lust is all that there is, and if you're the body, why not try it this way, that way? Whether you think you're a homo, hetero, whatever, what does it matter? The whole point is to get some kind of stimulation. So whether the people are from wealthy backgrounds or not, you're going to find that since the age of 12 or 13, they've done horrible things to themselves. Then you're going to find another group, less common, but definitely this group exists, of persons who somehow or other not blown themselves out to that extent, and they're completely focused on their career, job, what's going to be my status, university, corporation, totally locked in on that. And how are you going to relate to them? How are you going to attract them to Krishna consciousness? They don't want to, join an ashram and sleep on the floor. All they're thinking about is, I'm in the university now. I need, if not a double major, I need a triple major, just in case the field that I'm studying in is not economically viable. When I graduate, I'll have another concentration of study to fall back on. This is what's happening in the USA right now. It's not enough that you go to university and, say, specialize in, some kind of biology or business administration or computer science. You've got to specialize in it to make yourself more competitive on the job market. And those parents who are really wanting the best for their kids, they're pushing their kids to have three majors. That doesn't mean, less work. It means more work. More. That's the kind of pressure that's piling down on kids today, because it's so competitive, the job market. So those persons who have a bit of brain preserved, that's what they're thinking. Hey, I got to compete. I got to have a good CV. I got to have something I can present to a future employer. And here you are wanting to tell me about Krishna consciousness, and I should just say goodbye to the world, and I should shave my head. So we're losing on both accounts in terms of the Western population. Many cities are doing well with the Indian population. In my opinion, not too many cities are serving the Indian population. They're taking from them. Not too many are actually giving quality Krishna conscious care. But in any case, at least something's going on. But when it comes to the Western population, most city temples don't know what to do. And the leaders just feel, hey, Prabhupada told us to open temples, we establish a deity, we're doing all that, so what else do you want out of us? Now, I'm going to be presenting some quotes from Prabhupada that have been forgotten, some strategies that come from his divine grace directly that have been forgotten. And we may see that Prabhupada was much more broad-minded and strategic than we may accept now. So, how does ISKCON measure up to the preaching reality today? Well, I've talked about that to some extent. This is what I wrote in my report. Sad to say, an alarming number of cities of the Western world have seen our preaching decline into chronic irrelevancy and ineffectiveness. Often the temples are understaffed and financially precarious. If a temple can pay most of its monthly bills, it is deemed a successful urban mission. They're paying their bills. Wow. Glory is a problem. Wow, this temple's paying its bills. Or, if a temple in a Western city can minimally satisfy an Indian congregation of fortunate first and second generation pious migrants, then also the urban mission is considered satisfactory, even though it has failed to reach the host population. So, my point is that the current malaise or decline or very unfavorable condition of urban ISKCON in major regions of the West demands at least a rethink. We need to discuss how innovative approaches can attract all types of urban refugees, whether unskilled or professional, so they can participate in Prabhupada's mission and achieve his objectives. We'll be discussing some alternative strategies Prabhupada had. Let's see. I can give you some hints. What time are we to go on to? 10:40. Okay, and then we get 5 more minutes. Okay, we got about 20 minutes. All right. Let's see. Should I give you some appetizers of future sessions? But first, do you have any questions about what we've been saying so far? It's always nice to hear your visions before we move on. Any, yes? Yes, that may be true that they're so burned out. One thing I say again and again to persons when I meet them, persons in their 20s, late teens, I say, look, let's face it. In fact, I'll even do this when they're 19 years old. You're 19, you've already done everything that you could do. There's nothing more to be done. You've done it all already. And they agree. I said, the only different thing you can do is to do the same thing in different places. But you're 19, you've done it all to the max. What's next? You're right. Since the age of 12, they've been flooded by the things that adults used to wait to do until they were, 21, 25, 30. That's all going on now in teens. They travel around different countries. Teenagers do that in bands of other teenagers. They're completely intoxicated out of their minds by the time they're 12 or 13. All sorts of random lust encounters. There's no more deferred sense gratification. That concept's been tossed out of the window. Now, so from your point of view, what you're saying is, well, that should make them more open. But you have to understand the downside. I know, there's this verse in the Bhagavatam that says, sometimes if you have a fire and you put one drop of ghee on it at a time, the fire just gets bigger. But if you get a whole heap of ghee and put it on the fire at once, the fire may go out. So in that way, persons who have burned themselves out with a colossal amount of sense gratification, they may actually decide, I need to hear something else, let me come to Krishna consciousness. But there's a downside to that if it does happen. They totally destroyed themselves. You see, we may forget, especially if you've been in Krishna consciousness for some years, you may forget sense gratification destroys you. It totally weakens your physical and your intellectual capacities. So even though they may come to you with this sense of, oh, I'm totally fried. Oh, gosh, I mean, I've had, for example, in peaceful, idyllic New Zealand, pastoral, beautiful country, I've sat in a room of 16-year-old girls arguing with each other. They're all starting to practice Krishna consciousness, arguing that, no, I wasn't that bad. Between the ages of 14 and 16, I only had 16 intimate partners. You had 25. Really? And they didn't think anything wrong about it. I only had 16 in 2 years. But come on, you were with a different guy every night. I'm okay, but you were really out of it. This is what's going on. And then there was another girl. She was 16. She said, well, actually, there's no doubt, I'm practically the Virgin Mary amongst these other girls. In 2 years, I've only had 6 boyfriends. Boyfriends meaning everything. You know, these other girls, they're totally degraded, but I've only been with 6 in 2 years. That's because I had a good mother. I tell you the truth. This is what's going on these days. So the end result is you can't take these people and just put them in an ashram. We've tried doing that, and everyone's realized it's not working. But unfortunately, we took the wrong conclusion. Since it's not working, just give up on preaching. That's basically what's going on. Don't worry about reaching these people in Amsterdam or, you know, all these other kinds of cities, London. Don't reach out. Oh, you get burned. The Hare Krishna movement gets burned as soon as it tries to reach out. These people will, you know, they'll be grateful for a while. They'll say Hari Hari Bol for 6 months, a year, 2 years, and then they'll sue you. Or then they'll accuse you of something. Or they'll be doing horrible things in the ashram. So really, our confidence that Prabhupada gave us, that gung-ho spirit, that outgoing spirit, we can do it, we have the answer, that's all way down now. Everyone's very shy and these days. Ooh, you want to be a Hare Krishna? Ooh, that's nice. You know, actually, you know, we're all the same, you know, and it's very nice you want to be a Hare Krishna. And it's gotten that bad. So I think we need to take an honest look at the current situation, be for real about it, and then we can see what else that Prabhupada had in mind. Any other questions? Yes. 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 Well, you're the boss, whatever you like. At least
then even when they look for spiritual life, they're looking for some kind of amorphous love or something or other that won't really restrict them in too many ways, but kind of afford them some kind of spiritual excuse for their existence. And I think the devotees also, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that we're trying to make Krishna consciousness fit into the scheme of things.
Yes, I would agree with you in that we've kind of lost our dynamic focus due to not knowing how to cope with the realities these days, and therefore we figure, well, whatever, just like the New Agers say, whatever. We've kind of unconsciously a little bit veered in that direction. Whatever, I mean, you know, just practice Krishna consciousness the way you feel it should be for you, according to how you see Krishna consciousness. And that's what's happened. That's the reality. Now, before I give you an example, a real-life example from the U.S. Army, based on what you were saying, what you were just saying about New Age, any other points you wanted to raise before we move ahead? Yes. Interesting you're bringing that point up to me. You just reminded me one in London about a month ago. One Indian boy was about 19. He was telling me the same thing, you know, that I've got to do certain things. Otherwise, you know, I won't be able to take to Krishna consciousness. You know, my parents are from India, but I'm born in London. And unless I do certain things, experience certain things, and get frustrated, how am I going to be a good devotee? So this new agey type conception is even influencing, you know, the children of our Indian congregation. I've got to go through it, he told me. I've got to have my learning experiences. I've got to learn my lessons. Everyone's life has a particular lesson. There's a particular reason why we're on this planet. I've just got to get out there and do different things and find my own meaning. So, okay. It is true that if someone is frustrated and exhausted, they are prone to hearing about Krishna consciousness. But the question is, are we geared up to deal with these people? My point is, regardless of the frustration of the urban people, we're not geared up to deal with that. A constant theme in this presentation I'm trying to give is that if you want to preach in the city, you've got to be very serious about it. You just can't wave a hanky at the situation. You've got to really roll up your sleeves and get into it. And it's quite a challenge. It's quite absorbing. It's a great sacrifice. But that's the only way we're going to be able to capitalize in cities today. We have to have devotees who feel a sense of like a missionary. I'm in the city for a particular purpose, not because I like it, not because I think cities are convenient. No, in fact, I think cities are horrible places, but I'm here to reach out to people and to build Prabhupada's movement by reaching out to one person after another. It is my contention that this is the kind of conviction it's going to take, and then we need some proper strategies. Nothing else is going to work. And we've seen that for over a decade now. It's not working. When we just have our buildings in the city, we're just struggling to maintain, get a few donations. Oh, we've got a very nice Indian congregation. Our problems are solved. Do a homa, do a yajna, get some more donations. Oh, what's happened? It's just like in the USA. You know, the World Trade Centers came tumbling down. Let's have a homa. Otherwise, the Indians will give the money to the fire departments in the USA. We'll have our own homas. On and on it goes like that, you know. As for what to do with the people, the host population, we don't seem to have a good idea. And we don't even have the time. Maintenance is such a struggle. We've become a bit impersonal. We don't have that same Second Avenue spirit that Prabhupada had, of outreach and personal sacrifice, and I'll tell you more about that. Okay, I'll start now. No more questions you have before we move on? I always like to make sure that, you know, we're generally sharing the same space before we move ahead, generally. Anything else? All right, now, I'll read you a quote from Chaitanya Charitamrita, from a purport in Madhya Lila, chapter 24. Prabhupada writes, "The Krishna consciousness movement is meant to attract all types of persons, even those who desire things other than the Lord's devotional service. Through the association of devotees, they gradually begin to render devotional service." So think about that. This is Prabhupada's Siddhanta. This is not Gaudiya Mas Siddhanta. This is what makes Prabhupada different. This is why Prabhupada is the Kali Yuga Acharya, founder Acharya, of the most significant branch of Lord Chaitanya's tree now. He understood Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur like no one else did. And therefore, here in this statement, you'll see a flash of Prabhupada's genius. The Krishna consciousness, it's meant to attract all types of persons, even those who desire things other than the Lord's devotional service. But Prabhupada doesn't say, okay, then just leave it at that. They desire things other than Krishna service. Okay, whatever. No, he says, through the association of devotees, something else will come about. So Prabhupada, at the same time as being the ultimate pragmatist, how to get everyone, how to attract everyone, at the same time, he didn't change his tune. Once we attract everyone, next, how to get them to perform service to Krishna. So this is Prabhupada's brilliance. Now, I'll tell you some things about Prabhupada in the early days of ISKCON, which I've heard directly, first-hand accounts from devotees who were right there when Prabhupada said these things. I know that right now there is an unlimited stock of Prabhupada's saids, and they're getting more and more unreliable as the years go by. But these things I'm telling you come from persons who were right there and heard it from Prabhupada. So, I'm just telling you these things so you can think about them, and later, if you're coming to the next sessions, I'll show you how it all relates. When Prabhupada came to the Los Angeles Temple, the present New Dwarka Temple, when the devotees had just purchased it, it was a church. And where the temple room is now, for those of you who have been to Los Angeles, there were church pews, church seats. And Prabhupada told the devotees to leave the church seats in there and put a podium in front and use it as a lecture hall so people could come and sit comfortably and hear lectures about Krishna consciousness from someone standing at a podium. When Prabhupada came back, he was angry to discover that the devotees had taken all the seats out and had made a traditional temple room. They thought, we'll probably be so pleased, we've got a traditional temple room, we have big kirtans, we can jump, we can, huddy huddy bowl. And Prabhupada was angry. I heard this directly from devotees who were there. Why did you take the seats out? I wanted to create a nice atmosphere where the people could come and sit and hear about Krishna consciousness in a comfortable way. Why did you take the seats out? One devotee told me, I heard this personally, that when Prabhupada came, before the devotees took everything out, when Prabhupada came the first time, there was a church organ, and Prabhupada had one devotee who was a sannyasi play the organ. I heard this directly from the person. Play the organ. Play, Hare Krishna on the organ. So that's how Prabhupada was thinking. He was no small-time, village boy from India who, he was always thinking big, always thinking how to attract so many people to Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada's idea was that they would have one room for a traditional temple room, and that they would keep this main room, which is now the Los Angeles Temple Room, keep that for a big lecture hall where people could sit down and hear from a Krishna conscious speaker who stood at a podium. And there's nothing traditionally Indian about that. So that just gives you some idea of Prabhupada's capacity for strategy and how to outreach to others. What's another example? Mukunda Maharaj told me this. Because, as a few of you may know, I've tried to do a urban preaching strategy, which many people call the Loft strategy, because that was the name of the first place that we had. It was named that before we moved into it. It was called the Loft, so we just called our preaching center the Loft, because it sounded like a cool name where people could, I'm going to the Loft tonight. Instead of, I'm going to the temple tonight. for Westerners to tell their friends, I'm going to the temple tonight. It doesn't sound so cool. But if you tell your friends, I'm going to the Loft, that sounds pretty hip. So we just kept the name, the Loft. It was like that before we moved in. This is a place in Auckland, New Zealand. And so then, from that point on, everyone started referring to it as the Loft program, which meant basically, as I'll be explaining in the coming days, establishing a very comfortable, club-like atmosphere for people to find out about Krishna consciousness, to make a very warm atmosphere for them to come to Krishna consciousness and grow in Krishna consciousness and then decide which lifestyle in Krishna consciousness they want to pursue, and also for them to learn how to distribute Krishna consciousness like that to others. So we have a mission statement. These days, every organization has to have a mission statement. It's supposed to be a short mantra that summarizes the whole inner dynamic thrust of the organization. Maybe some of you have mission statements for your Krishna conscious organizations, or you work for corporations that have mission statements. It's like, I think Federal Express, FedEx in the States, I think it's absolutely overnight. Just a couple of words like that. You know, we'll get it there overnight. In other words, absolutely overnight, our deliveries will be done. You'll get your package, your courier package the next morning without a doubt. So a mission statement is supposed to be something that really galvanizes you. It energizes you. It's your whole focus, why you're in business. So I'll show you what the mission statement is we've developed for these urban preaching centers. The mission statement, in short, is we make it easy. That's our whole approach. We make it easy, number one, to come to Krishna consciousness. Number two, to grow in Krishna consciousness in an organic, balanced, wholesome and healthy way. And number three, we make it easy to distribute Krishna consciousness to others. So we'll be talking more about that in the coming days, but I wanted you to just get a look at this mission statement. We make it easy. This means, basically, we're going to serve you to make your access, your approach to Krishna consciousness easier. That's our reason for living. We want to give you what we have, and so we're going to do our best to make sure you have the most comfortable and pleasant and understandable approach to Krishna consciousness and a chance to easily grow in Krishna consciousness in a realistic way. At the same time, we want you to learn how easy it is to distribute Krishna consciousness to others. So that's our mantra, our mission statement. We make it easy. Immediately that implies service. We are using our energies to make your life easier. Your life in Krishna consciousness easier. Okay. Now, you'll understand it more in the coming days, but I'll just tell you this for the moment. Mukunda Maharaj was telling me, he said, you know, you're not doing anything new. I know what it was like before Prabhupada had Second Avenue, even before. Prabhupada would have programs in lofts on the Bowery. Yeah. People would say to Prabhupada, hey, do a program in my loft, because that's where the cool people lived in the Bowery in New York City, all the bohemians, the artistic types, they lived in lofts under the roof. So they would invite Prabhupada, do a program at my loft. And so Prabhupada would do programs at these artist lofts, and he would, and Mukunda Maharaj was telling me, Prabhupada would talk to them about India, fascinate them with stories from India, and then after, you know, he would tell them about India, they were all interested, you know, in India. He'd just tell them, you know, not necessarily directly Krishna conscious things, but just things that capture their interest. Of course, he would always have some Krishna conscious purport there. And then after he talked and he did some kirtan, he would go around distributing whatever little prasad he had cooked to the people and making small talk with them. Mukunda Maharaj told me, Prabhupada would just walk around, how did you like the samosa? Oh, how you doing today? How's your job going? Like that. Prabhupada was doing like that. Making small talk, circulating amongst the guests, and just, you know, as making friends. So Mukunda Maharaj was telling me, he said, honey, you don't think you're doing anything new. This is what Prabhupada did in the beginning. This is how Prabhupada got things going. To the extent that when he finally got Second Avenue, then he expanded upon this approach. And he started building something that very important that we're going to be discussing a lot in the coming days. Prabhupada started building camaraderie. Does that word, for those who are not, if English is not your first language, camaraderie, everyone knows what that means? Anyone? Camaraderie means like bonding, you know, bringing people together and establishing relationships, building, how should we say, friendly bonds between devotees. That's what Prabhupada was doing on Second Avenue. For those of you who English is your first language, you know this word, camaraderie. It's like, you know, the feeling that friends get when they're together and they're relating and talking about their lives. And I'm sure in your own languages you have a word like that. In fact, down under in Australia and New Zealand, they won't so much say camaraderie, they'll say mateship. Mateship. They don't use the word friend so much down under. We say mate. Here's my mate. It means here's my friend, you know. So I'm sure in your own language you have that kind of, you know. So this is what Prabhupada was building on Second Avenue. Camaraderie, friendly relations. And then once he built up a group based on friendly relations, he then proceeded to send them around the world to distribute Krishna consciousness. So Mukunda Maharaj is telling me, you're not doing anything new. This is actually how Prabhupada started his urban preaching. So when I heard that, I realized perhaps we all need to go back to Prabhupada's Second Avenue example and reignite the preaching again. What has happened is that we've kind of been insulated and isolated behind our temple walls. Okay, this is what we've been doing for the past 30 years. We have an institution. We have a building. If the people want to become Krishna conscious, they'll do it. If not, yeah. That's basically what, yes?
Mm-hmm.
He personally would do that.
Yeah.
Ah.
But now, you know, there's so many rules and regulations, so many proper things and improper things, and how even someone does come into the temple, they can't really do much except for, you know, wash the dishes or make a garment and take a shower and change their clothes.
Yes. I agree 100%. Very good point. We're going to be dealing with that in the coming days. That's all part of We Make It Easy. Lower the cultural barriers. You know, you're not dealing with, you know, people who've been practicing Krishna consciousness for decades. You're dealing with newcomers. How can you make it easy for them to approach Krishna consciousness? And then water will seek its own level. So yes, I wholeheartedly agree with that. So it's very interesting. You know, this point, how Prabhupada would personally go into the, you know, coffee places and drag out the, hey, it's time for class, guys. Come on. I can tell you more examples like that. So reoccurring theme of this presentation is going to be that we probably should get back to Prabhupada's original style so we can reignite our urban preaching again. We've gotten quite comfy behind our closed doors and the walls, and you know, everything is Vedic and everything is pukka, and oh, okay, there's a place for all that. Hey, I'm not knocking it. But meanwhile, the people are suffering, and so many of our temples are empty. So that when Indians come on Sunday, we're so happy. Oh, someone's here. Donation, please. We have a new fund for this, a new fund for that. Would you like to give? on it goes. One last thing, which you have to take in context. I hope no one's here from the UK. Right? No one's here from the UK except Charnarina. Anyway, you won't tell anybody these things. Mukunda Maharaj personally told me this. When the first 5 devotees came to the UK, sent by Prabhupada, They thought the first thing we should do is obviously just get into preaching to the Indian population. There's so many of them here. And this is, of course, don't take this to mean that you shouldn't, you know, preach to those very fortunate and pious persons who can easily take up Krishna consciousness because of their fortunate past life. No, we're not saying that. But just look at the way Prabhupada would spin our minds just to get us to have a right vision of the situation. Mukunda Maharaj said they started preaching to the Indians in London and having a good time doing that. Yes. Last 10 seconds. Thank you. And Prabhupada came to London for the first time. And he said, what are you doing? Why, you know, I didn't send you here to preach to Indians. I sent you here to preach to the British. So this is not to say, you know, no, I'm adding all the, you know, precautionary statements. Don't take it in a fanatical way. But just to show you Prabhupada's vision, what he wanted. Ah, there you go. Same thing in Toronto. Okay. Anyway, we're going to end right here. And I just wanted to give you some idea what we'll be talking about in the coming days. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Glory to Prabhupada. Another field.